The Church at Ross Bridge is a bridge to belonging, believing, and becoming in Jesus Christ. We hope you enjoyed this message and visit our website at rossbridge.church.
Morning, church. Outside of the 27 books of the New Testament, we find a common statement in first century Judaism, a blessing. May you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. Now, what in the world does that mean? It implies that in a dusty culture, on dusty roads, on a nomadic journey of trying to follow God's will, you're closely following behind a spiritual leader. We're beginning our own journey, 8 weeks of practicing the way, beginning this Sunday, along with all those small groups you heard mentioned in the video. For the next 8 weeks, we'll be learning what it means to practice the way of Jesus. Our faith in the New Testament was not called Christianity. There's no scriptural record of it being labeled that way. Instead, the persecutor of the church, Saul, was actually a persecutor of the way, a way of living that Jesus' disciples followed in. We're going to learn to practice that beginning today in Matthew chapter 4 as Jesus calls his very first followers. Would you read responsively with me? I'll read the light print and ask you to read the bold together. Matthew 4, 18 through 25. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I will send you out to fish for people. At once, they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed him. I've never done it before in a sermon at this church, but here's a map of the first century. Israel was kind of a vertically oriented country with Jerusalem in the southern part off of this map. But 90 miles north of Jerusalem is there the Sea of Galilee with a series of villages surrounding its perimeter. Jesus had grown up in Nazareth, which is about 40 miles to the southwest, a rural small community of probably just a few hundred people. But then we learn in the other Gospels that around the age of 30, he relocates to the seaside village of Capernaum. This is a picture of modern-day Capernaum. You can visit there, as some of you have, when our church has gone to Israel, or maybe you went with another group. That's the actual city and its historical remains. And it was there that Jesus settled. It was a city of around 10,000, we believed, during the first century. And so Jesus leaves Nazareth, moves to Capernaum. He gets baptized by his cousin John in the Jordan River and then goes into the Judean, southern Judean wilderness southeast of Jerusalem for 40 days of fasting and prayer. And when he comes back, he begins his ministry, three-year ministry, there in Capernaum. And along that very shoreline, he is walking and he sees Simon Peter and Andrew, who are in the process of fishing. And Jesus calls them to follow him. Now, my Bible calls this section, Jesus calls his first disciples. And this has been captured, as has the calling of the disciples in Luke and Mark and John. They're all a little bit different. This one has been captured in a painting 700 years ago by an Italian artist. You can see Jesus standing here on the shoreline of the sea. Jesus is almost always wearing a combination of blue and red, and he's calling out to Simon Peter in the middle. Now, we know that Simon Peter because Simon Peter is typically in art depicted wearing either light orange or yellow. And sadly, that's because it references a part of his own redemption story. He was a yellow-bellied coward who denied Jesus when Jesus was arrested. And so he's depicted in that way, typically in art. Andrew, the patron saint of some of the great British Isles and Scotland and other places, is depicted in green, and really because of his association with that geographical part of the world. And they're in the middle of fishing. I mean, in the middle of the task, they have their nets in the water, as depicted here with Andrew, his hands on it, the fish being captured. It's the middle of a work day. They're just trying to earn a living. And Jesus interrupts them, Simon and Andrew, with an authoritative invitation. Come, walk behind me. I will make you fish for people. Now, I have to admit that I always thought that Jesus was just kind of taking advantage of their activity and creating a metaphorical parallel to the work that he wanted them to do by saying, well, you're fishing. I want to help you fish for something else, give you a new purpose, but built upon the metaphor of your general vocation. But just this week, I realized Jesus is not the first person in the ancient Near East or Greco-Roman history to talk about fishing for people. So he's not just conveniently building upon the metaphor in the moment. He's actually drawing upon a history. In ancient Greece, you can read about it in the Sophist written by Plato or other elements of like the Greek Dionysian tradition. But there are these stories of these Greek gods who fish for human beings. And they are trying to kind of conscript these human beings into their agenda. Sometimes it's not a very noble agenda. And they try to lure them in using bait, because that's how you catch fish, right? And so in some of them, they use erotic pleasure to draw human beings and then they capture them. In others, they dangle wine before them. They're fishing for human beings. What that tells me about Jesus' statement is that he may not only be drawing upon the vocation of Simon, Peter, and Andrew, he may be saying that he knows that there are other entities in the world that are out for the harvest of human souls. And they play upon the most base human desires in order to lure them in. And if these people are caught, they are enlisted in the agenda of the gods, whose agenda is not always for their own good. Jesus is different than that. He calls Simon Peter and he calls Andrew, and in a way is saying, I'm going to take the kind of role that you have in the world and give you a much deeper, broader, transformed purpose. And they accept on the spot. And that has always kind of puzzled me. If you go home this evening, it's a beautiful day. Maybe you're sitting on your front porch and somebody walks by on the sidewalk, or you're at work tomorrow morning and somebody walks by your office door, or you're filling up your cart at Publix on aisle two, and someone walks up who says, excuse me, you don't know me, but I'm a religious authority figure. And I have an agenda for your life, but you're going to need to leave your cart, or don't finish the email, or don't complete reading the book on the front porch. Stop what you're doing and get up and follow me. And I'm going to give you an entirely new set of goals and agenda for your life. And by the way, there's no guarantee of any kind of compensation or any particular outcome to this other than you're supposed to follow me. You wouldn't follow that person, and neither would I. I'd call the cops. Like, who does this person think they is? Like, what is their agenda? And whenever I find, I've learned this in reading the Bible and generally in life, when I find myself saying, I don't understand why somebody would do something like that, rather than sitting in judgment of the decision that they've made, I've realized I'm actually confessing my ignorance. I don't know. I need to be educated. So I went on a deep dive into the nature of first century rabbinical discipleship and preparing for this series, drawing on the work of John Mark Comer. Jesus was not the first or only Jewish leader in Israel who had disciples. A few years before him, we can read in extra-biblical history that there was a rabbi called Rabbi Hillel. Rabbi Hillel had about 80 disciples. After Jesus ascended to heaven a few years later, Rabbi Akiva had a big following. Only 5 inner circle disciples, but it's said in history that thousands across Israel followed him and applied his teachings. John the Baptist, the cousin of Jesus, had disciples. Some of John the Baptist's disciples actually become some of Jesus' disciples. And Saul, the great persecutor of the faith, before he became Paul, had disciples and was a disciple of Gamaliel, we read in the book of Acts, who was the most well-known Jewish rabbi during the time of the early church. The term disciple in your Bible might be translated in any number of ways. They are all faithful translations, but it could be translated as follower, or as learner, or as student. But when you place the word mathetes in the Greek within the social context of the scriptures, you realize that their concept of learning, following, and being a student is very different than the kind of ways we think about education in the 21st century. The way that I've been educated, and most of you have been educated, is you go sit down at a desk or table in a classroom, and an instructor lectures information, and you are required to either prepare for an exam to see how well you've learned it, or to write a paper, and you'll be judged on how well you have mastered the information that has been kind of given to you. That's not the nature of first century rabbinical discipleship, which is why most New Testament translators and scholars now say, you know what? The closest thing that we actually have in modern English to a first century mathetes, disciple, is apprentice. So everybody in the first century world would have understood that a disciple was an apprentice because everybody would have apprenticed at some level in spiritual discipleship for Judaism. Let me tell you what I mean. There were three basic levels of how this apprenticeship was experienced. The first is called Bet Sefer. If you lived in a town or village that had a synagogue where there were religious leaders teaching, then when you were a student from 5 to 12 years old, their version of elementary school was Jewish religious education. You went to learn the Ten Commandments, the Shema prayer of Deuteronomy chapter 6. You learned about the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their families. You learned about Moses and King David and Rahab and Esther. And you got to know the story for 7 years, and you could regurgitate a lot of it from straight memory. But at the end of those 12 years, you had an obligation to go back and start working in the family business. You had to apprentice at home, whether your families were fishermen, like James and John, son of Zebedee, who's also in the boat with them. They're learning from their dad. Whether you were a craftsman like a carpenter or a stonemason or a farmer, you went and you learned the family trade because that was how you were born. Well, the best of the best from the Bet Sefer could actually participate in Bet Midrash. Just a small percentage, but they were allowed to go and participate from age 12 to around age 17. Coincidentally, about the age from kindergarten all the way through high school. And it was a deeper dive study because you had demonstrated you had great intellectual capabilities. You were a student that was worth investing in because you yourself might. At the end of Bet Midrash, if you were among the top in your class, had one of the highest GPAs, so to speak, you could apply to apprentice under a rabbi. And the concept is that by apprenticing under a rabbi for several years, you yourself would become qualified as part of the uber-exclusive kind of academic and scholarly class to be a rabbi yourself. Does that sound or look like anything in 21st century American Christianity? Not much. Our models of spiritual formation, spiritual education, are quite different than that. A modern functional definition of a Christian, as we use it in kind of general conversation, is basically a person who says, well, yeah, I trust that Jesus forgave me for my sins and I belong to that church over there. I go kind of regularly, I routinely participate. But in contrast, a first century definition of a disciple was an apprentice who sought three things. One, to spend time with their rabbi. Two, to become like their rabbi. And three, to replicate their rabbi or do as their rabbi did. That, to me, is a major difference in how we employ those terms between Christian versus disciple or apprentice. And the data actually supports that there should be a difference between those terms. Back in 2023, George Barna partnered with Arizona Christian University to produce the American Worldview Inventory. This is something that's conducted, it's just a study, research study, kind of around sociology of religion in America. And they're studying things like church attendance up or down, or you know, biblical literacy up or down, things like that. Well, in this study, they found that the percentage of Americans in 2023 who self-identify as Christians is about 63%. But They went further and broke down essentially categories of New Testament discipleship into a different question. And the way it was phrased was, the percentage of Americans who live as apprentices to Jesus, 4%. That's a big difference, isn't it? Christian, the term Christian, shows up in the New Testament 3 times. But mathetes, apprenticeship, discipleship, 269. You see, to be a disciple of Jesus was not to say, you know, I read this book by this person, and they really have some good ideas. I would recommend it to you because it's changed the way that I think about a few things. To be a disciple meant that you had identified a spiritual sage. They had found the secret of life and meaning on earth. And you were going to put your future on the line in order to spend time with them and try to soak up all of their way of thinking and their way of living so that you could become like them. So, finally, if you dig a little bit deeper into the 3 features of first century rabbinical discipleship, you would find a disciple's chief goal was to become just like their rabbi. Okay? This is not a person who recognizes that Jesus has some special miraculous power or interesting interpretations about the Old Testament. And I agree with, say, 95% of what it is that they say and do, but I have about 5% that I hold on to because I'm kind of an independent thinker and I'm not going to buy in full. No. This is a person who says, I don't want to have any opinion other than your opinion. I don't want to act in any way other than exactly the way that you would act. And there was an investment for the rabbi in this too, because those who were the rabbi's disciples reflected on the rabbi. So the rabbi should have an interest in these people saying, look, I want to become a mirror image of the way that you think, how you speak, how you treat people, the way that you view the world. All of your goals in life are going to become my goals. May my personality decrease, and may your rabbinical personality increase in me. And there just aren't many professions left in the world where your process of training sounds like that, are there? But occasionally you'll hear one. I heard one 5 years ago. Our church bought this building in 2018. We began renovations. And as we were changing the layout specifically on that end of the building, that required, you know, a lot of electrical rewiring in places you can't see up above the ceiling. Totally new engineering diagrams and blueprints because you had new light fixtures and light switches and so on. So this team of electricians were present in the building for weeks. And I noticed one day as they were working in this closet to your left, they were actually installing the junction box with the electrical and data for that monitor right there. And there were some supplies in there. We were a very small staff. And so they were like, hey, what do you want us to do this stuff? I said, hey, we'll come move it for you. So me and another staff member went down there and were moving some things out as they got to work on that particular aspect of the project. They put a ladder in place. And I noticed, I had seen them before, almost joined at the hip. There was about a 50-year-old master electrician. He was one of the leaders on the project. And he had next to him an apprentice. And he looked to be about 18 or 19 years old, just a young man. He was following around, assisting with things. And I got to overhear their interaction, and it went something like this. The master electrician was up on the box, and he says, I'm going to wire in this junction box, and then you do the next one, so watch me. Yes, sir. So he does his work, takes the plate off, connects everything the way he should, puts it back together. It's all right, your turn. Young man goes up on the ladder. He gets about 30 seconds into it. The master electrician says, hey, stop. What are you doing? I'm connecting the... Why are you doing that? Well, I thought that's what I was supposed... No, no, no. Did you see me do that? No, sir. Then why are you doing it? I don't know. Well, I'll tell you why. Either you decided that you knew how to do this better than me, or you weren't paying attention. Now, which is it? I guess I wasn't paying attention. I guess you're right. Why don't you get down? I'm going to do this one. Now, you watch me, and you do exactly the way I do it. And I thought to myself, that's how I want to manage Lawson. Stop doing that. He wasn't being a jerk. I mean, he wasn't angry. His voice wasn't raised. He wasn't speaking in a derisive way to this young person. He was training him. Because if he just decided as a young apprentice that he didn't like that philosophy of electrical engineering and he'd like to wire it up his own way because I'm a creative free spirit, well, either it's not going to work or you're going to burn down Ross Bridge. Something was at stake. And something is at stake here too. The formation of human souls around divine truth. And the first priority for a disciple in the first century was just to replicate their rabbi. So how did they do that? That's the second feature of first century rabbinical Judaism or rabbinical discipleship. A disciple committed to sharing all of their life with the rabbi. All of it. You know, I imagine I could see a spoof of this scene in Matthew 4 of Jesus approaching Simon, Peter, and Andrew. Come follow me and I will teach you how to fish for people. And Simon and Andrew saying, okay, could you text us your TED Talk? We would are totally willing to watch that and consider the merits of your ideas. Do you have a podcast? Like, we'll listen to it. Anytime you put out a new episode, you do a weekly email newsletter or blog, we'll read it. Or there's a coffee shop over here. Would you like to meet once a month for an hour? And we'll kind of listen to what it is that you have to say, or maybe even twice a month. We'd be willing to give that much time out of our fishing schedule. And they left their occupations, they left their homes, and they left, covered in the dust of their rabbi, walking closely behind his footsteps, and they ate the meals that he ate. They laid their head to rest at night where he slept. They engaged the same people in public ministry. They listened to Jesus. They started adopting his accent. And maybe the biggest difference between that model of discipleship and the ways that we think about having a relationship with Jesus has to do with the amount of time we are actually carving out of our lives to spend with Jesus. Many Christians that I know, they have their agenda. They have their goals. They know what they want their life to look like and where they want to get, but they would like to have a spiritual advisor. They would welcome Jesus' spiritual counsel. I mean, who else would you have solve your problems than Jesus? But Jesus was not interested in just dispensing information. He was interested and demanded total reformation of a person by sharing all of life with them. The third and final feature of first century rabbinical discipleship is that a disciple applied for acceptance from their rabbi. So if we begin reading halfway through chapter 4, if you read the early part of chapter 4, you'll read about Jesus going into Capernaum and going to the front office of the University of Capernaum and said, I'd like to speak with the dean of the Honors College. Do you have a list of students that I could review their academic performance, their internship placements? And that's where he got the names Simon, Peter, and Andrew, and then James and John. And when he approached them in the boat, he said, if you've got a copy of your transcripts and your CV and all of your community service hours and the extracurricular activities, and then you've got some letters of recommendation from Bet Sefer and Bet Midrash, I'll review those and then I'll get back to you on whether or not you make the cut. We do not have an example in history of a Jewish rabbi who initiates recruitment, especially of these guys. There is literally not a single prerequisite that Jesus looks for before issuing an invitation. And if you read the profile of the disciples, I mean, you've got fishermen, you've got tax collectors who conspired with the Romans against their own people to levy unfair taxes against them. You've got Simon the Zealot, who was probably an insurrectionist and wanted to kill the Romans and drive them out of Israel. And they're all invited? I mean, no other rabbi acts this way. Whosoever will. Oh, you've been betrayed in your background. You've been abused. You got fired. You're sinful. You're self-righteous. Friends, what is far more important in following Jesus is not our level of commitment when we arrive at the conclusion that we should follow Him. What is far more important is that prior to that, He has been seeking you and me out. He believes in you. He believes in me. That we could, by His example, by His inner life, His Spirit in us, we could begin to think like Him, speak, act, as salt and light. You know, I've been the beneficiary of some incredible mentoring in my life. Now, I sought that out mostly. But some of the most important mentors of mine were not people that I identified as being really effective and really wise and somebody I want to kind of get close to them and allow their wisdom to kind of, you know, influence my life. Sometimes it was them seeking me and seeing something in me I couldn't even see in myself. My wife and I got married on August 13th, 2005 and moved to Gainesville, Florida so she could begin graduate school at University of Florida. We're not proud of that, but she did go to school there. We'd been married for 8 days and I didn't have a job. She got married to me when I was unemployed. I was looking. I wasn't just laying around or sitting around, but we were moving to a new city and I had not secured employment yet and knew God was calling me into the ministry, and I just happened upon in a printed newspaper a job description posting for a director of children and youth ministry at First United Methodist Church. So I looked up the address. I drove by on Monday morning. We'd been married 9 days at this point. Had my resume, and I found the signs to the church office, and I walked in and left my resume. 2 days later, after a couple of interviews, they offered me the job, and I worked there for the next 3 years. But when I walked into that sanctuary, this is a picture of that sanctuary. Beautiful. The miracles of Jesus and the stories of Jesus in stained glass around the edges of the room. Incredible pipe organ, all these chandeliers. The choir was in robes and the clergy wore some really fancy stuff. And these kids would come down the aisle in the first hymn carrying these little torches and they'd light a candle. Another one had the cross and they'd stick it. It was very formal, very developed and sophisticated. I did not grow up in a church like that. And I felt a little out of place, a lot out of place. Everybody was so nice and kind. It was not some kind of snobby institution at all. It was more of my own feelings of insecurity. I mean, I grew up in a small town in South Georgia. I grew up in a very working class family. My parents didn't finish their college degrees until I was in elementary school. They went on further after that. But we lived on the lower edge of the socioeconomic spectrum. And for most of my childhood, we could have qualified for federal food stamps. But they hired me. Earl Parker, the senior pastor, hired me. I'd been there just a few weeks, and Earl and I had just kind of hit it off. He was like, "Have you ever thought about seminary?" "No, sir." "Well, why not?" "Not ever something I really thought about. That's not really me. I mean, you should think about seminary." "Yes, sir. Okay, I'll think about seminary." Every Thursday, we would have lunch. We became deep friends, and he was the first most impactful mentor in my professional life and friendship life, even though he was 40-plus years older than me. And as time went on, Earl retired, moved to Tennessee. We continued our time in Gainesville, and we would talk on the phone a couple times a week. We arranged a couple of family vacations. Here we are in Disney World together when Henry was just a little guy in a stroller. Very, very close with them. And when I would call a couple times a week just to check in, every third, fourth conversation, he'd bring it up. "So what's next for you? Doesn't Cameron graduate in May of 2008? Like, what are you going to do? You need to go back to school." And I finally said, "Okay, I'll apply, but I don't know that I'm going to get accepted. I don't know if I could afford to go. Seminary is expensive." And he's like, "Just apply." So I applied. I got accepted. I was offered a pretty generous scholarship. And I called her. I was like, "You won't believe this. I have a letter of acceptance here." And he's like, "Well, of course you did. they'll take anybody at seminary, you know. He had a real gift for being painfully blunt. Chewed me out more times than I can count for things that I did. And so I said, that's great, but, you know, Cameron's going to graduate in May, and look, we've got a house here. I've got a great job. We love the church. The church is happy with the work we're doing. She's expecting our son at that time, and she's going to graduate. She could get a job here. There's a job opportunity at the VA hospital. It's a good job. He's like, I know that, but you need to think long term here. You really need to go. Okay. So we stepped out on faith, and it scared us to death. And with a six-week-old child, we sold our house and moved to Nashville and both started new jobs, me part-time and her full-time, and I started school, and we were just kind of in over our heads. But somehow, 2.5 years later, I'd made it through, kind of slogged through the curriculum. And at Benton Chapel, we celebrated graduation that day. My parents were there. They had just moved to Nashville, but Earl and Elaine drove over from East Tennessee to attend and celebrate. As we all processed out onto the lawn and everybody's congratulating and cheering and celebrating together, we were about to take some family pictures, but Earl came up to me and I could tell his eyes were red, and he just squeezed me and he whispered, you know, we both waited for this day, haven't we? And then he pushed me back and squared my shoulders and looked right in my face and just said, you know, I always knew you could do this. He could see something and challenged me for a future that was not on my radar at all. And friends, I believe that's maybe the most important thing about Jesus' reimagining of discipleship. You do not have to have the top GPA in your class. You do not have to have the perfect family system that you come from. You do not have to have your career goals all laid out in sequence. You can be a terrible student and have a broken past and be just wandering through life without any direction at all and just listen for His voice. Come, follow me. And He can absolutely see a future for you. You cannot see it for yourself. So I want to ask us a tough question today. We'll be asking it the next 7 weeks. Are you willing to apprentice as a disciple under Jesus as your rabbi? Or are you willing to settle for just being a Christian? Lord, I'm thankful today that You don't call us to follow You without providing the light for each step of the way, one day at a time, daily bread. We don't always know where we're going when we're in Your hands, but we know You will be with us, and You can equip us and desire to give us moment by moment enough wisdom and courage to make it the next decision in front of us to be made in a way consistent with Jesus. Thank You for that great hope. Lord, what a joy it is to live with that calling and invitation upon our lives. It's in Your name we pray. Amen.
The church at Rossbridge is located in Birmingham, Alabama, and helps people find abundant life in Jesus Christ.